Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, I wonder whether you've started to dabble in the stock market recently. I mean, despite all the economic uncertainty in the last year and a bit, the number of Australians turning up to invest for the first time has apparently skyrocketed. I say this with caution, but it's of course the market has been going up. In fact, since the pandemic, the stock market's gone up something like 10%. House prices have gone up by something like 19%. It's all, I suppose, due to low interest rates, making borrowing easier. It's not really a surprising, I suppose, when you think about it. After property, which, as I say, is not always accessible to everyone, investing your money in shares is often held up as a surefire plan to wealth and financial security. Maybe it can be, but I'm sure you need some careful planning. If you're sitting on the outside, it might also seem like a bit of a dark art. So how do you get started without running the risk of losing all your savings on some dodgy shares recommended to you by your mate at the pub or even someone in a newspaper column? We obviously talk about investing, as I say, fairly frequently here on the program. But if you're brand new to the whole thing or have been thinking about giving it a go, then tonight is for you. So we're going to look at investing for complete beginners. And hopefully we can cover everything from working out your appetite for risk to the difference between managed funds and direct investment, as well as managing your portfolio once you're up and running. Joining me is Shani Jayamana, investment specialist at Morningstar and co-host of their podcast, Investing Compass. Shani, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, Philip. It's great to be on Nightlife. Thank you so much for having me. Well, and I'll try to be quick. I feel like everyone's hanging out to hear about the cows being toilet trained. So.
well, yes, all things in good time. Yeah. We're in the middle of a pandemic, potentially heading into a second recession. No one really knows what's going to be happening at Christmas, let alone further on. Is it a good time to be taking their, for people to be taking their first dip, do you think, into the world of investing right now?
Yeah, you're right, Philip, and what I'd probably say to that is that there's always a degree of uncertainty to investing. So no one has a crystal ball about what's going to happen. And we saw a perfect example of that last year when the market and the economy were going in two separate directions. We saw lockdowns across the world, businesses closing, and we had absolutely no idea where this pandemic was going to take us. And I don't think we still have much clarity compared to what we had then. But apart from that fall in March last year, we've seen strong market performance that has rewarded a lot of investors investing in equity markets. But, you know, I think what I would say to new investors that if you are constantly waiting for the right time is not going to happen. Jumping into the market is always going to be scary when it's your first time, and it's just never going to feel like the right moment, especially with all the market noise that surrounds you. So I'm a long-term investor, and you know that's the philosophy that we prescribe to at Morningstar. We don't believe in looking at the markets at 1 month time frames or 3 month time frames, looking towards Christmas, etc. And it's important to think of investing as a long-term endeavor, because it is over the long term that investors are rewarded. But I do understand the fears surrounding the market at the moment. We do see a lot of well-known professional investors and a lot of indicators that that the market does seem to be overvalued. And when I say overvalued, that means that the price and the value in the market is deferring. So you're paying more than the value that you're getting when we're looking at markets overall. And what I'd say to that is that there's a proverb that a lot of advisors and investment professionals use, and that's that the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago, and the second best time is now. So yes, I completely agree that there's lots of uncertainty in the market, but I guess the best advice that I can give to new investors is zoom out on the markets and what they've done in the long term. Since, let's say, 1900, if we look at the US market, you can pick any year in that period. So pick any year between 1900 and now, and in 20 years time, you would not have achieved a negative return. Same goes for Aussie markets, but any 16-year rolling period. And what matters to investors and not what is not what happens in December or next year. And that's what matters to speculators, people who are speculating and trying to predict the future and what's happening. But we at Morningstar, and, you know, I think that's starkly different to investing. And
Yeah, because, I mean, there's a bit of a mood on at the moment, isn't there? It's, I mean, the market's been rising now for some time, and you could be forgiven for thinking if you're new to it, oh, this is how it always is. It isn't.
Oh, exactly right.
What would you say to new investors about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what new investors do need to keep in mind is that with the markets running and rising, a lot of the new investors haven't experienced a bear market and they haven't experienced a tumble. And I think one thing that's really important with investing is that you're confident and you know what you're investing in. Because if you don't, when a tumble does come, it's very easy to take your eyes off the prize. And a lot of investors do divest at that point. So I think what's important and the best advice I can give is to understand what you're investing in, understand why you're invested in it. So have a goal. So hitch your investments to a goal that you have in mind and a time frame. And that'll increase the likelihood of you sticking it out for the long term and not pulling out your money when you shouldn't.
All right. My guest is Shani Jayamana. She's an investment specialist at Morningstar, co-host of their podcast, Investing Compass. And we're looking tonight at investing for beginners. Shani, one of the interesting things is that perhaps somewhat counterintuitively, the COVID pandemic's actually seen a rise in new investors. Data from the research house Investment Trends put the number of active online investors in Australia at a record high of 1.25 million. The Australian Stock Exchange has reported similar findings as well. Their in 2020 investor study reported an influx of younger investors to the market. What do you make of this? What do you make of the number of people turning to the market? Is it because, I mean, everyone loves a winner, I suppose. Is that it?
Yeah, I think that is. And I think, you know, we in the industry were kind of scratching our heads at what was going on when this started happening. But it's so encouraging, I think, to see. And it's great that investors are getting into the market, and especially younger investors, which is what the study shows as well, because they have longer time horizons where they have an opportunity for their returns to compound and create wealth. I think from my personal experience, I'm a young Australian, and obviously putting aside my occupation, if you can, I live in Sydney, where I've either been priced out of the housing market or, you know, like others, I might be saving for a property. You have large sums of money sitting in cash, earning nothing and losing value. So the alternatives haven't been attractive. And I think a lot of people have jumped into the equity market because it has been running since the GFC with only a few hiccups, and the barriers to entry are low. And I think the worry with this is that although it is fantastic that young investors are hopping into the market, as we mentioned before, Philip, I think all these investors have not experienced a proper bear market, and I think that's where the problems start. And if and when the market changes, these investors, they won't really know why or what they're invested in, and that's when poor behavior occurs. And I think that's why it's so important, and we believe really strongly about this, that investing, you should have a goals-based approach. So instead of going out and investing in that hot stock that you hear or see on some forum, understand why you are investing and define your goals. So define what it is you're trying to achieve and by when. And then from that, you're able to calculate a rate of return that you can aim for, or the amount you need to achieve as a return to get there. And then based on that, you can choose your exposure to growth and defensive assets. So how much of your money you're investing in equities versus cash, fixed income, etc. And then the final step is finding investments to match it. So there is a bit of a process. There's definitely a process to this, and it's like building the foundations to a house. And over the long term, having this base and structure is going to serve young investors when the market does turn eventually, instead of just investing in something that they hear about at the barbecue.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I was going to ask you that before we get to define or constructing a portfolio. What do we know about where all these new investors, as they are getting into the market, where they're getting your information from? I mean, is this something you should be leaping into without proper advice? You see sometimes people huddled around mobile phones talking about these things. Where are people getting advice from, and where should you be getting advice?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So that same study that you mentioned, Philip, which is the ASX Australian Investor Study, it looked at the information sources that people were using when making these investing decisions. And what they found was that about 60%, 60 to 65% of these new investors, they rely on friends and family and newspapers. And I think what's important to note here is that both of these sources would be relying on other people's experiences, or would not be a holistic look at your personal situation and what might be the right vehicles to get you to your financial goals. And, you know, I said this before, but it's important when you're setting yourself up in investing, that's at the forefront of your mind. People, they don't invest to beat benchmarks or beat the market, they invest to reach financial goals. And that could be a house, a holiday, a comfortable retirement, anything that, you know, has money attached to a goal. And these goals differ from person to person. Your circumstances differ person to person. So your wage, your expenses, your financial responsibilities. So I think it would be folly to think that any investment someone chats to you about would be right for you right off the bat.
Rosie from Annandale is with us. Hi, Rosie.
Yeah, good evening. My question is this. My son has money invested in an online phone app. This one's called Raise. And I think the deal is that they promote it as you put in the balance of a cappuccino or whatever. But I discovered recently that he seems to have $2,000 or $3,000 tied up in this thing. And it sounds to me pretty dodgy because it sounds completely unaccountable. But I just wondered whether it's legit, whether you've heard of it and it's actually perfectly okay.
Yeah, Rosie.
Shani?
Yeah. So I've definitely heard of Raise. I actually have a little bit of money invested in Raise. So it is an application that is something called micro investing. So micro investing is something where you can invest small lump sums in there. So I think their minimum is $20 that you can invest in there, and it grows from there. What it does provide you to is exposure to different sets of ETFs. So their portfolios have different ranges of exposure to exchange traded funds within it. So Australian equities, international equities, bonds, Asian equities, just a bunch of different ETFs in there. And you can invest small amounts as well. And, you know, $2,000 to $3,000 is quite a large sum of money to invest in something if you don't understand it. But I think in terms of Raise, the fee structure is quite different to what you'd expect from different investments. So very, very simply at a high level, and they charge a flat fee up to a certain amount. And I can't remember the certain amount at the top of my head, but I think you do need to have a certain minimum investment for it to make sense. Right. So I think
Rosie wants to know whether it's dodgy at all. Shani, you'd say no. You'd say no.
I really hope not, to be honest. I hope not.
You've got money there. Okay.
Yes. No worries.
Thanks, Rosie. So essentially, it's like being invested in an ETF, is it? An exchange traded fund.
It's more of a managed fund structure, okay. So it's not listed.
You better explain some of these terms for us, Rosie.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, there is a bit of jargon, and it does get a bit technical when you go into this stuff. So what I mean by that is that it's not listed on a stock exchange. It's in a trust structure. So it basically what it does is it will invest in ETFs on your behalf and then hold it within a trust structure.
Right. Okay. All right. But as a way to begin, to put in small amounts of money, you would think these kinds of things are okay?
It is if it makes sense to you and your purposes.
Sure.
So I think, as I mentioned, it does have a flat fee attached to it. And that flat fee, I think, is $3.50 a month at a minimum. Mm-hmm. And if you are investing $20, $30 a year, it's really not going to make sense for you to pay $3.50 a month for that fee. So I think the amount that you're investing definitely has to be justified in terms of the fee as well. So, there are a few considerations with investments like this, especially the amount that you're investing and the fees that they're charging you. So those are a couple of the things that I'd look at.
1-300-800-222. We're talking about beginning to invest and getting into the market. Sue from Newcastle says, evening, is being in your late 50s too late to start? I do have some investments, but I'd like to do it on my own, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I definitely don't think so. I think investing is for every and most stage in life, and 50 is still young. My parents are older than that, and they still invest, and I get them to invest. And, you know, I think the longer time horizon that you have, the more that your investments can compound. But that in no means does that in no means means that 50-year-olds are shut out of the market. You have a 20, 30, 40, 50-year time horizon, and you still have a lot of time to be in the market. And there's obviously different types of assets that you can invest in. It's not just, you know, really aggressive equities that you can invest in. There's stable dividend providing income, stocks. There's also, you know, fixed income options. There's all different types of options that you can invest in. It's definitely not too late.
All Right. Rex, well, actually, this topic had to come up, I suppose. Rex, hello. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Phil. Hello, Shani. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Not bad. I'm just interested in your thoughts on the cryptocurrency side of things and how you decipher what's good and what's bad, and, you know, everything's popular at the moment. But, you know, for the layman people, we haven't got a clue, to be honest.
Look, I'd probably say that a lot of investment professionals don't either. So you're in good company. And look, personally, I don't invest in it, and I don't invest in any cryptocurrency. And I know that at Morningstar, our opinion is that we'd rather not invest in something that has no underlying asset. So what we mean by that is, when you invest in equities, you're investing in a business. And, you know, Bitcoin is not like that. It's, you know, it was a cryptocurrency that started in 2009. It's really been gaining in popularity. It offers an alternative to centralized currency, but it's also given rise to speculative traders. And the difference between speculative traders and an investor is pretty simple. An investor looks at an investment like equities as the owner of a business, and a speculator views himself as playing with expensive pieces of paper with no intrinsic value. So for speculators, value is only determined by what someone is willing to pay for that asset, and Bitcoin has no underlying value, and that's what makes it speculative. So it's purely based on demand and limited supply, and it's an extremely volatile investment, and it's unregulated. And this just means there are more ways than a few to lose your money, and it can be due to loss of value, but it could also be due to fraud, misplaced passwords, thefts, and, you know, misplaced passwords has been a very common one as well. And it does allow owners to move money with relatively low barriers across borders, which is what a lot of people have found attractive. And that's because
Have you got in there, Rex? Have you done it yourself, or you're thinking of doing it?
I've been watching a platform that has multiple so-called blockchains or coins or whatever.
Well, there's hundreds of different coins out there, aren't there? Yeah.
Well, yeah, this particular platform's probably got at least 30 or more. Hmm. So anyway, it sounds like a big smokescreen.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would say is, you know, invest in what you know, and this is something that I don't really have much interest in, just because it has no underlying assets that you can attach any value to, and it's so hard to understand where it's going to go. So, yeah, that would be my thoughts.
Okay, all right, Rex. Do you think? You tell me, Shani. You say it's a speculative investment. It's essentially gambling, isn't it? To a degree.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess it is. There are, you know, we have this podcast, and our producer Will invests in Bitcoin, and he says that you're really just investing in an idea, and this idea is that it could be a catalyst for growth and efficient trade across borders, and that it's, you know, comparative to the internet back in the early 2000s, that it was an idea that a lot of people didn't know where it was going to go, and the growth of it. And I think that's sort of where people that are on the Bitcoin bandwagon are sitting, and that that they will see growth, but not something for me, unfortunately.
Yes, all right. Shani Jayamanes with us, investment specialist at Morningstar. We're talking about beginning investments. Yes, we use the term ETF? We did. Sorry, we shouldn't use any acronyms without explaining them. What's an ETF again? What's an ETF again, Shani?
Yeah, so an ETF is an exchange traded fund. And what that means is that they're baskets of securities. So securities could be our equities, and they are traded on a listed exchange. So it could be traded on the ASX.
Okay. All right. Beginning, before you invest, you need to have a look at what your debt situation is, don't you think? Because what your level of debt is going to determine whether and how you should begin.
Yeah, for sure. And I think debt is one of the few ducks that you should get in a row before you take the leap. And that includes debt. Obviously, if you have a personal loan or credit card debt, I'd probably pay that off first before jumping into the market. And I think that's because it's important to understand that these products usually charge extremely high interest rates. These loans or credit cards, they can often snowball with accumulated interest. So it's important to pay off these liabilities. And you know, the bottom line is that it's unlikely that you'll be able to earn an investment return that's higher than the interest rate. So if you look at most credit cards, you'll see that on the market, they vary between, you know, 18 and 25% interest payments. And what this means is that any money that you borrowed, you've got to pay that 18% back per year. So if you borrowed $1,000, you'll be paying $180 just in interest payments for the year. And these are pretty significant costs. And when you invest, an 18% return in a year would be phenomenal. I know, Philip, you mentioned how crazy the returns have been this year. And it's obviously been a crazy year for the markets. But if you look at the past 140 years, if you look at the US stock market, it returned 9.2%. And the worst decade in the 1930s, it was about minus 4%. So I think you'll be hard pressed to find something that's going to make keeping that debt worthwhile. And then, you know, there are a couple of other ducks that I would get in a row before you start investing. And one of them is budgeting. So making sure that you understand the surplus that you have when you are investing, especially if you're committing to an investment feature that makes you commit a certain amount at certain intervals. So those are two of the main things. And I think one of the most often forgotten elements before you do start to invest is an emergency fund. And all an emergency fund is a pool of savings to cover unexpected expenses.
How big should an emergency fund be for a single person?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, the purpose of it is, I mean, to cover unexpected expenses. So it could be medical expenses, a car breaking down, unexpected time off work. And I think you kind of need to account for the worst case scenario, which is that unexpected time off work. I think industry regulations, most guidance, it suggests 3 to 6 months of salary. And that's just
based off, not many people would have that, Shani. Not many people.
No, I don't think so. But I
mean, especially young people wouldn't have 6 months worth of salary socked away.
No,
no way.
No. So, I mean, I prefer to follow a guideline of 3 to 6 months of expenses instead. But it's a personal choice and it's ultimately what works for you. So, I mean, I've seen a lot of personal finance blogs, you know, acknowledge that it is unrealistic for a lot of young investors. And they've said to start with small amounts. So, you know, just $1,000 to have those immediate expenses that might come up covered, because they do acknowledge that obviously it is a large amount of money to save up. But it is important that you're prepared for the unexpected, and I'll explain why. And that is basically because when you do invest, you need to make sure that you're able to keep your money invested. And that's what an emergency fund does. You don't want to be invested in the market and then, you know, your car break down, or you know, something happened in your kitchen that you need to replace, and that's a huge lump sum cost. And if you have to pull out of the market at a bad time for you and your investments, that just means that you're not going to be as confident going back into investing, and you're going to make a loss. So that's what an emergency fund covers for you.
Okay. 1-300-800-222. How do you get started? If you're a beginner investor, any questions at all, give us a call. Annie says, I would like to give my son a $3,000 investment for his 20th birthday to get him started. That's very nice of you, Annie. What's the best thing? Would an ETF, this is an exchange traded fund, be best? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it completely depends on the situation. You know, $3,000 is enough of a lump sum to make brokerage make sense. So I think an ETF that's low cost, something that you can get into, is fine. And obviously, he's going to keep it for the long term. So, you know, a passive investment, which means that there's no active stock picking, which means that the costs are low, that would be something that I would probably look for.
Right. What sort of ETF, how do you choose a good one? Shani?
Yeah, that's a great question.
I mean, I know it's the $64,000 question, but how do you pick a good one? Or what are some basic rules?
Look, I think there are quite a few steps before we get there, Philip. And I think those steps are really understanding why you're investing in an ETF in the first place. I don't think that it should be invested in isolation. It should be something that's considered surrounding your goals. So, you know, we spoke a little bit about the portfolio construction process earlier, and basically what that means is setting up the foundations for your for your portfolio. And there's a few steps to that. So the first is, you know, defining your goals, how much you actually need to achieve that, a required rate of return, so per annum what you need.
When you say defining a goal, I'm sure most young people say I'd like to make as much money as possible.
Yeah, so
is that a goal? That's not a goal, you'd say.
Yeah, I mean it's not really, and I'll tell you why. So at Morningstar we're proponents of goals-based investing, and you know what you're referring to, Philip, is something called wealth maximization, which is an old approach to investing. And wealth maximization is an approach where you just try to make as much money as possible, and this doesn't work well for a few reasons. And the main reason is that people have varying circumstances, and that's a one-size-fits-all approach, and it doesn't really take that into account. Each of us is unique, we have different goals. So everyone's approach to risk and return should be different as well. And failing to define those objectives or goals, they can have several consequences. So the primary investing related consequence is not having any sense of the actual return objectives that you need to meet your goals. So in other words, that's the return that you need to get to your goals. And this leads to investors going into one of two default modes, and that's risk avoidance, where too many assets are kept in safe assets such as cash, and you know, not getting to the goal that you need to, or wealth maximization, where too much risk is taken relative to your goals and timeline. So you do need quite a bit of structure around this.
Okay. Matt's on the line. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Phil. Hi, Shani. How are we going tonight?
Not bad.
Great, thanks.
That's the way. So basically, my partner and I, we put away $50 a fortnight for our son, who's one. And once it reaches like $1,000, we're sort of looking to invest it. We bought our first lot of shares in like one of the big four banks. We're sort of wondering, with, you know, diversification of your portfolio is always talked about as a good thing. Like, should you sort of handpick sort of those blue chip stocks, so to speak, like the big fours or the mining giants, or is an ETF or something to look into? What do you sort of recommend in the diversification, and that for, like, you know, return? We're sort of thinking when he gets to 18, like a car, any, you know, tuition you might want to go and do or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, you're a great parent for doing that for him. So I wish I've got a hex debt that I've been trying to pay off for years. And that's going to continue on for a while. So I think you're doing a great thing. But what I'd probably say is that it depends how involved you want to be in the process. And, you know, I think these ETFs and managed funds, they're great for a hands-off approach. And, you know, I think especially with the big four banks and, you know, the miners and whatever else, they do make a large proportion of the Aussie share market. So you are kind of you are exposed to a lot of concentration when you are investing in that, and you are investing in the Aussie market. So what I would say is that I would diversify over time. You can either do that by diversifying with individual stocks as you move on, you know, that $50 per fortnight, you can invest in different stocks and diversify into different industries, sectors, into different regions as well. Or alternatively, you can just invest in an ETF and then just continue putting money into ETFs as you go forward. So it depends how hands-on you want to be, how much research you want to do, and you know, why you're picking the investments that you are. So why have you chosen the banks, and why have you chosen BHP? Is it because you think they're a good investment, or just because they're in the Aussie market and they've always gone up? And you know, if that's the reason, then you might as well stick it in an ETF that's, you know, got more coverage.
Yeah, awesome, thanks very much for that, I appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks, Matt. It's a great thing. I mean, and you'd hope when he gets to 18 that he continues on with the investment rather than
exactly it.
Yeah. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Greyman asks a good question. He says, I don't know why people don't just put more into superannuation. After all, it's invested for you. And the extra is tax deductible. There are many tax advantages of being in superannuation. The major downside for young people is you can't take it out again until you get to retirement age. Is that the only big negative in that sense, Shani?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think he is spot on. I think that if you don't have any clue in terms of what you're doing at the moment, or how to invest, or how to open a brokerage account, the easiest thing you can do is invest in your superannuation towards your retirement. And I think, you know, I'm at a stage where I do have financial goals, but back when I first graduated and I started my first job, I didn't really have anything that I was aiming towards apart from a comfortable retirement. And superannuation was the perfect vehicle for that, because, you know, if you want to get started investing and you want to invest for your retirement, there's so many positives to do this through superannuation because the tax rates are favorable. There's lower barriers to additional investment. So no matter how much you have, they've obviously got to take it because, you know, your employer payments are going in there. So there's, you know, no real barriers to entry for additional investments. So I think if you're a new investor, that's one of the greatest vehicles of sort of getting started with investing, because most of them have BPAY codes now. You can literally do it in 30 seconds and invest into your super.
Hmm. All right. Ross says, I currently have a bank term deposit, which is currently earning very small interest, approximately 0.2%. So it's hardly worth the effort. Well, you're going backwards on that, aren't you, with the rate of inflation as such as we have. Is there any other form of secure investment that earns something better than a term deposit? Shani?
Yeah, look, what I'd probably say is that there are obviously bank, there are different savings accounts that you can go into, high interest savings accounts that'll have more than that 0.2%. There's annuities, there's, you know, a little bit more of a riskier, you know, there's alternatives, there's peer-to-peer lending, there's those sorts of investments. But what I'd probably say is a lot of people do see cash as really unattractive since you're barely earning a return at the moment. But I think it can still play a really important part in portfolios for many investors. And cash is, of course, really important if you're planning on making withdrawals from your portfolio as well. And, you know, it's really hard to see cash sitting in your account earning nothing. And, you know, there's a lot of conversations about how volatility isn't the enemy for long-term investors. But I think if you do need to take money out, the last thing you want is to have to sell equity investments at low prices after the market has fallen. So I think cash is a really important part of your portfolio, regardless of whether you're returning a good return. And, you know, I obviously hold cash in my emergency fund, but I'm young and know that I can ride out a market fall. But, you know, my colleague and co-host Mark, who hosts the podcast with me, he holds cash and he's been building a cash reserve now because he sees that the market is overvalued and ready to take on opportunities. And, you know, same with Hamish Douglas, and he runs one of the biggest funds in Australia as part of Magellan Financial Group, and he's held quite a bit of cash for a while now through the pandemic, and he said he'd rather not invest until he's seen opportunities that he's confident in. So you're in good company for holding cash. And I think what a lot of investors have done is we've seen the substitution effect, and what the substitution effect is that we've seen a lot of investors leave these asset classes that really aren't giving them any return. And these are investors that are struggling to create income for themselves and going into equities. And that's really where they're finding it at the moment. Unfortunately, you do need to consider that risk return trade-off and go into something if you do need to generate that income. But cash isn't always a bad thing.
Okay. Right. Shani Jayamana is with us from Morningstar. We're talking about beginning investment. Michael, hello. G'day, Michael.
Hello, Phil.
Yeah, not bad. Hi, Michael.
Hey, good, thanks. Just with regards to some shares that I inherited, and it all came to me just before all this COVID stuff, and it worth was the value of it was half of what it was before it all happened, and now it's all back to where it was. But this inheritance comes with a the tax implications with regards to capital gains and so forth. So, you know, so if I was to sort of sell it all now, I would lose 30-40% of it to capital gains, whereas it's going to pay sort of a little income going forward. And I'm thinking, well, what do I do? It's all in the banks. 90% of it, it's in the banks. So what do I do?
Well, at some point,
do I hang on to them going forward, or do I look at something else?
Shani, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to speak without knowing the rest of your financial situation. And I just think generally.
There's no other debt or anything like that. I live with a 2- and a 4-year-old. I turned 50 this year. I've just got these shares.
So, like, Michael, you're asking whether you should sell them and invest in something else or just hang on to these?
Well, that's both ends of the spectrum, Phil.
Yeah.
So is there something, or do I, you know, start playing with things that I really don't know about anyway?
Yeah, I think there's a few levels to this. And, you know, the first is that if you're not confident in what you're doing, there's obviously professional advice out there that you can lean on. And depending on obviously the amount that you've inherited, that professional advice can or can't make sense. And I think the worst thing you can do at the moment is probably play with something that you're not too sure about or not confident about, and don't take too many risks with it. So what I'd probably recommend is, especially with tax situations, and you know, tax isn't my specialty. I did a couple of accounting courses in uni, and it definitely wasn't for me. But it is very complicated, and I think you should definitely probably seek some professional financial advice on this account, especially if it is a large sum.
Yeah, well, I mean, I looked to do that, but just before COVID hit, and it was going to cost, you know, a couple of $1,000 to do that, and I sort of ummed and ahed, and then COVID hit, and I didn't do anything for panic more than anything else. And then, you know, like, what are we, 18 months later, and the market sort of recovered to where it was in the shares that I've basically, it's in the bank. So, you know, they're back to where they once were. And reading all the stuff that the papers have got to say, it's all about, you know, like all the banks are overvalued and whatnot, and you should be into something else.
Yeah, I don't know. Shani, what do you think? In terms of options that are available?
Yeah, look, what I'd probably say is that professional financial advice, you know, financial advisors aren't always your only option. There are different resources that are available to you. And I think, you know, I'm obviously a very, very big proponent in terms of researching and understanding things, understand what you're invested in at the moment, past what the newspaper headlines are saying, understand the companies that you're invested in, and then understand if that's something that you want to be invested in for the long term. In terms of what Morningstar think at the moment in terms of bank shares, it's very in line with what you're saying. So we think, you know, Westpac slightly undervalued, CommBank and NAB are overvalued, and ANZ's fairly valued. So very, very similar to what you're saying. And, you know, I think we don't see in, you know, a 2-3 medium term outlook, 2-3 years, we don't see that changing. We don't think that the earnings growth is going to be extraordinary in any way because of a couple of factors, including, you know, regulatory and compliance spend and capital expenditure and modest credit growth. And, you know, we've seen a lot of household risk aversion and deleveraging. So I think there are quite a few things that are going on with the banks. I would definitely say if you don't really understand where you're at the moment, I would try and make an effort to understand that and understand the businesses that you're invested in, and then go from there.
Thanks, Michael. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Warren's got shares in Sydney Airport who are being taken over, I think, at the moment, aren't they, Warren? Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, hi. How are you going? Sydney Airport are under offer to be taken over. I've bought at a low price, and they are a good investment as far as I can see.
You'd have a smile then at the moment, Warren, would you?
Yeah, on this particular one, yeah. If they are taken over, the question is, if they are taken over, do the shares then roll into the new company, or do I get paid out? Have I got a choice?
Yeah, look, that's a very good question. I don't have any insight in terms of that, unfortunately, Warren. In terms of the individual share level, I'm not too sure where it's going to go from there, unfortunately.
Okay. You'll have to seek some other advice. Sorry, Warren. All right. When we've set some goals, Shani, we've set some goals. Now, what are we going to do then? We've set our goals, and you say we should also talk about asset allocation. Once we've set out our goals and plans, we have to work out where we would like to put our money. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, exactly. So there's one step before that, Philip, and that's having a required rate of return. And a required rate of return is an output foot from something called a time value of money formula. And, you know, I won't go into the math on that, but there are a few inputs needed in that. So the first is time horizon. So how much time do you have? The amount that you have at the moment, so your initial investment, how much you're looking to contribute as well. And then you should be able to get from a variation of that, you should be able to get a return that you need. And, you know, say, for example, if I had, if I wanted $1 million for my retirement, I've got 20 years to reach it, and I've already got $200,000. I'm contributing $20,000 a year. I would need 6.5% return per annum. And that's what will inform my split of defensive and growth assets. And that's what we call asset allocation. So asset allocation is how much are you going to allocate to Aussie equities, international equities, bonds, cash, et cetera, based on that 6.5%.
Mind return. You, though, I mean, isn't it the case that higher returns equals higher risk?
That is definitely, there is a relationship between risk and return. And that's something that all investors do have to consider. But I think over the long term, that risk return trade-off, especially with equities, has paid off for a lot of investors.
Ash in Sydney says, is it just while we're talking about asset allocation, is it possible to get Shani's thoughts on ethical investment? I'd like to stay true to my values if I venture into investing.
Yeah, so I think ethical investing is definitely a bit of a controversial topic. And, you know, I believe in ethical investing. And I think regardless of whether you do believe in, you know, ESG, and which is environmental, social and governance, and whether you believe in it or not, I think it's something that all investors do need to be aware of, because that is where the industry is moving, and that is where investments are moving, and it will impact the way that your investments work. So I think a great example that, you know, my co-host Mark uses, he had a conversation with one of the equity analysts that work at Morningstar who covered Coke, so Coca-Cola, and he was talking about how, you know, ESG might not mean anything to me, but if I own Coca-Cola, I still have to understand water supply and where water is coming from, because that really impacts my investment.
And tell me about it. Just explain what ESG is again for people who are new to this.
Yeah, so ESG is it stands for environmental, social, and governance, and basically what it is it's looking at a firm and how they actually look at environmental factors, social factors, and governance factors.
Mm-hmm. Well, and deciding whether they're any good, in other words, whether they align with your values. All right.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right. Go on.
So that's basically what ESG is. And, you know, there has been a bit of a movement in investing where a lot of investors, especially young investors, are moving towards this. So, it is a bit of a rising trend where investors are choosing not to invest in things like armaments, coal, you know, alcohol and tobacco, those sorts of issues that they might have moral obligations that they don't really believe in.
Okay. All right. Josh on the line. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Philip and Shani. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
I'm a young man. I'm in my mid-40s now, and I have, you know, some, you know, sort of liquid cash, sort of 40K or so. And there's been a question these last months, what do I do with it?
I mean, Josh, I think, you know, I've said this a few times in the episode today, and I think it is important to know, like, what would you like to do with it? So do you know do you have any financial goals that you're saving it towards?
Well, the obvious one at, you know, my age would be to look, I mean, I actually don't own a house, so it would be to look at it and sort of say, okay, well, what could I do with, you know, 40 plus K in the suburbs of Adelaide in terms of investing? Or it could be something else, the sort of in the direction that you've already spoken about on the show.
Yeah, I mean, Josh, it could be both. It could be both. It depends on your time horizons. You could invest it to get to that goal. So you could invest that $40,000 to make it a deposit in, you know, 5-10 years, and that's something you could consider as well.
When you say deposit, you mean house deposit, or like,
yes,
you put,
correct.
Are you saying put it into some other sort of equitable management, whatever you'd call it, with an outcome that it would turn into something larger and then put that into a house? Is that what you mean?
Yes, exactly. So the latter. So using that investment that you have, that $40,000 that you have, putting it in investments and creating a larger deposit and a larger base for you to buy a house if that is something that is aligned with your goals.
Okay, well, that sounds great, Shani. But where would someone like me, where would I start looking, who I would contact to do something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I would probably say, you know, I would reach out and look at educational resources to understand different types of investments that you could look at. So, you know, obviously this nightlife segment is a great start, but I would look at, you know, we've got a few free resources at Morningstar as well. So we've got an investing bootcamp webinar, and that really goes through a lot of the foundational investing topics that we have. It's free. You can just Google it, or you can go onto YouTube and type in Morningstar Oz. And that gives you a lot of background in terms of what investing is, different types of places you can invest this money, and it's completely free. You can just watch it and see what your thoughts are after you actually get a little bit of knowledge about where the direction is that you want to go.
Fantastic, Shani.
Okay, thanks, Josh. All right, we've talked about risk, we've talked about asset allocation, we've talked about goals and emergency funds. In terms of selecting investments, one of the big choices is whether to go for a direct equity investment or a managed investment. Now, let's start with managed investments because we've been talking a bit about those. What's the difference between, and what's better, an ETF, that's an exchange-traded fund, or an LIC? One of my listeners wants to know, what's the difference between these? What's an LIC?
Yeah, so I can start with explaining what an LIC is. So an LIC is a listed investment company. Mm-hmm. And it's also, so as it says in the name, it's listed and it's a trust. So it offers, you know, exposure to a broad range of assets, exactly like an ETF would. It's professionally managed, so you do have a manager that's managing the assets there. But it is, you know, a trust structure, and the underlying assets are valued. So it's a little bit more like a managed fund in terms of how it operates, but it's closed-ended. So what that means is it doesn't issue new shares or cancel existing shares. Investors just join and leave. So there's a little bit of there's some complexity to it, but I can go on and explain in terms of managed funds, ETFs and LICs. The last, you know, ETFs and LICs, they're listed assets. It means they're traded on the stock exchange, and then there's managed funds and they're unlisted and they're trust structures. So there's pros and cons to all of them, but what I'd say is that ETFs and LICs, they offer accessibility, and because you can access it on the stock exchange, mm-hmm. and managed funds offer flexibility in terms of additional investments, because for the majority of them, you don't pay brokerage like you do with listed assets.
Right. So this is a better approach generally if people want to start off, is it? Is it better to go down these two routes other than saying, well, I'll choose six shares and buy some in each?
I mean, it depends how confident you are and how interested
you are.
No, well,
I'm not confident because I'm a beginner. So I don't know. So I'm starting. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say that it is definitely a great place to start, especially with ETFs and managed funds, because they do have professional managers behind them, and you can choose two different versions of these investment products. So there's active and passive. And active is when you have someone actively picking stocks behind the fund. So you have a professional manager going out and picking stocks that they think will perform better than the average market return. Then you also have passive, which is just following something called an index. So it would consider a factor within the actual index. So most of the time it's market capitalization. And what that means is how big the company is. So you see a lot of ETFs like the ASX 200, which is the 200 biggest stocks in Australia. And there are very easy ways to just put your money in, diversify, and you can just let it sort of develop over the long term.
Hmm. In general, is it a truism that mostly managed funds don't beat the market? So in other words, don't get too excited about promises of people promising above average market returns.
Yeah, so we actually publish a report every 6 months. So Morningstar publishes a report called the Active Passive Barometer. It is US focused, but the US market and the Australian market in terms of these funds are very similar. So the insights can be comparable. So the latest reports, what the results reveal is that generally you are right, Philip. The actively managed funds have failed to beat their benchmarks, especially over longer time horizons. So what it's found is 24% of all active funds, they topped the average of their passive rivals over a 10-year period. So it's not very good. It's not even a quarter. What that really means is that these stock pickers are finding it really hard to beat the market. But when we actually look at where the success lies for them, it was higher among international funds, real estate funds, and bond funds. The lowest success rates were with large cap US funds, which are extremely well researched and watched. So what this really means for us is that when you're looking for exposure to these large cap stocks, so those are those large companies in well-researched markets like the Aussie market or the US market, you're probably better off going for a passive fund because although it's not impossible, it's really hard for these active managers to find opportunities in these markets, and opportunities that can justify and make up for those higher fees in performance are few and far between. So I think a really important point in all of this is that these active funds are more expensive. They have more costs. These professional managers are expensive. They have teams that are expensive, sure. Analysts that are expensive.
Okay. All right. Well, I hope we've wet your toe, as it were, if you like it in with us. Shani Jayaman has been our guest investment specialist at Morningstar and co-host of the podcast Investing Compass. And I suppose if you Google that, you can find that, Shani.
You should, yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much for your time.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.